Tensions are elevated in Lebanon as Israel widens its operations.
We have to be prepared for some sort of response. We have to make sure that we are ready, and we are. We believe we have the force capability we need in the region, but it's not clear right now. Too soon to know.
Another overnight bombardment of Russian attacks across Ukraine.
At around 3 a.m., the explosions became louder in my own neighborhood. From the window, I was able to see the intense air defense battle with the approaching drones.
And millions on the verge of starvation, what some Sudanese are eating to survive. A new era in leadership of the NATO military alliance and Britain's milestone in its effort to reach sustainable energy goals.
Today is Monday, September 30th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint.
Good evening, I'm Steve Karish with Lori London. Israel unleashed a series of overnight attacks in Lebanon and announced the killing of another high-level Hezbollah commander. The strikes aim to further degrade Hezbollah and stop their missile attacks on Israel, following airstrikes that killed the group's chief, Hassan Nasrallah. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
Smoke still rises Sunday from what's left of high-rise apartments after an Israeli strike in the suburbs of Beirut on Friday. The Israeli military says it was targeting the leader of the U.S.-designated terror group Hezbollah. The group on Saturday confirmed the death of its leader, Hassan Nasrallah. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu labeled Nasrallah as someone set on destroying Israel.
Nasrallah was not another terrorist. He was the terrorist. He was the axis of the axis, the central engine of Iran's axis of evil. He and his people were the architects of the plan to destroy Israel.
Meanwhile, Hezbollah's biggest backer, Iran, raised a black flag atop the Imam Reza's shrine following Nasrallah's death. The sign of mourning came as Hezbollah issued a statement saying Nasrallah joined his fellow martyrs, while vowing to, quote, continue holy war against the enemy and in support of Palestine. As hundreds of families now sleep in the Beirut streets, joining what the Lebanese government says are 1 million displaced people, the Israel Defense Forces released a series of videos claiming to show strikes against dozens of Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. Israel says it warned civilians to get out of the way. But the country's leader blasted Israel's offensive. Lebanese caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati speaking on Tel Liban as provided by AP.
Unfortunately, the law of the jungle that controls the world has made the Israeli enemy stall all efforts for a ceasefire and continue its war against Lebanon because it does not care about the law or international legitimacy.
Overnight attacks this weekend continued in Beirut, prompting concern for what may follow. Meanwhile, hundreds of demonstrators in Baghdad protested Nasrallah's killing and attempted to breach the fortified Green Zone in Iraq, home to the U.S. Embassy. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week as provided by the social media platform X.
We're watching this very, very closely to see how, if and how, Hezbollah and or Iran may react, as well as the militia groups in Iraq and Syria. We have to be prepared for some sort of response. We have to make sure that we are ready, and we are. We believe we have the force capability we need in the region, but it's not clear right now. Too soon to know.
Lebanon's health ministry reports more than 1,000 Lebanese dead and 6,000 wounded in the past 2 weeks. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
In a developing story now, early reports indicate that Israel has launched small precision raids across the border into Lebanon and that a larger ground operation is being planned. This according to two officials who spoke with Associated Press journalists anonymously. VOA cannot yet independently confirm this. It is not clear if Israel has made a final decision on a broader operation. The Israeli military did not comment. Make sure to follow VOAnews.com for the latest as the story continues to develop.
The U.S. military is increasing its air support capabilities in the Middle East and putting troops on a heightened readiness to deploy to the region. President Joe Biden directed the Pentagon to adjust U.S. force posture amid intensifying concern that Iran-backed Hezbollah leaders could prompt Tehran to retaliate. Hezbollah militants, meanwhile, are vowing to be ready for any potential Israeli ground operation. Correspondent Jacob Russell in Beirut joins us for an update on the ground and what could come next.
The atmosphere in Beirut is extremely tense at the moment. The Israeli airstrikes have so far largely been confined to neighborhoods which have a mostly Shia population, because that is where Hezbollah has most of its support base and most of its infrastructure. So inside those neighborhoods, many of them are largely empty at this point because people have fled those areas looking for security from the airstrikes. But when there are people left, the atmosphere is very tense. People are very angry. They're very afraid. There's constantly drones circling overhead. Also, Hezbollah has been struck so many blows recently in such swift succession that people are also, Hezbollah themselves and their supporters are also extremely paranoid about espionage and about infiltration. For example, anyone with a camera is considered to be dangerous immediately.
What's the general population's opinion on Hezbollah there?
It's very hard to make any statements about the Lebanese general public's opinion because for a long time, Lebanese identity has been divided along sectarian lines. So as I said, in Shia neighborhoods where Hezbollah have a lot of support, opinions do vary, but largely they still have support. The people feel themselves to be aligned with Hezbollah and therefore feel humiliated, frankly, by what's happened to them recently.
There are indications that Israel begin some sort of ground invasion.
Ground operations from the Israeli army into Lebanon would change the dynamic of the conflict quite significantly, because while the Israeli army remains in Israel, they hold a massive technological and military advantage over Hezbollah in that their air force is huge and very sophisticated. Once they send troops into Lebanon, then Hezbollah would have some kind of advantage on the ground there because they know that terrain very well. They've established military infrastructure inside that terrain, and they are talented guerrilla fighters.
What about Lebanon's caretaker government? What, if any, role do they have in all of this? Is it safe to say that Hezbollah seems to have more power than the caretaker government in Lebanon?
Hezbollah was a significant part of the political establishment in Lebanon. It wasn't just a military organization. It is, in fact, a political party. And it was the most powerful political party, and it really held the tiller in terms of where the Lebanese government went. With the decapitation of Hezbollah's leadership, it really throws the situation of the Lebanese government into confusion, because at the moment, as you say, it is a caretaker government. It's a fairly inept caretaker government. It doesn't have resources. State services are, although they've improved slightly from, you know, in the last year or so, they're negligible at best. Hezbollah, whether it was supported or opposed, was the kind of gravitational center of the Lebanese government. So this, it remains to be seen how they kind of reestablished their leadership and their command structure. But as it stands now, there is something of a vacuum in Lebanese politics.
Correspondent Jacob Russell in Beirut, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Meanwhile, in Ukraine, Russian missile and drone strikes were reported in at least 11 regions, including Kyiv. Anna Chernikova has the latest from the capital.
In the early hours of Monday, Russian forces conducted another massive missile and drone attack across Ukraine. The capital city of Kyiv was one of the main targets. However, air defense forces were active in 11 regions of the country. The last night's attack on Kyiv was one of the most intense in weeks. The sound of explosions lasted for a couple of hours in different districts. At around 3 a.m., the explosions became louder in my own neighborhood. From the window, I was able to see the intense air defense battle with the approaching drones. It was something similar to fireworks that we are used to for festive occasions, but this occasion was not festive at all. According to preliminary information provided by local authorities, debris falls were confirmed in six districts of the capital. No damages or casualties were reported in Kyiv. However, relatives of Ukrainian soldiers told me on the condition of anonymity that some military personnel based in Kyiv were injured as a result of the attack. On Sunday, Russian forces conducted a deadly attack on the city of Zaporizhia, which remains under constant heavy shelling by Russian forces on a daily basis for the past months. 16 people were injured, including 2 children. President Zelensky confirmed that Russian forces hit a residential building and municipal facilities. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian general staff confirmed the destruction of a Russian arsenal in the Volgograd region of Russia with a stockpile of Iranian missiles. Later, a satellite image of the Russian area which was attacked by the armed forces was made public. The satellite image from September 29th shows that a fire broke out near the arsenal. However, the Russian service of Radio Liberty reports that there were probably no hits on the territory of the arsenal itself. VOA cannot verify this information independently. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Elsewhere in Europe, as we saw a few weeks ago in Germany and France, the political right is continuing to make gains, this time in Austria. Reuters' Gabe Singer has that story.
Austrian voters handed a first-ever general election victory to the far-right Freedom Party on Sunday. Their victory is the latest sign of rising support for hard-right parties in Europe that appears to be fueled by anxiety over immigration. The Eurosceptic Russia-friendly party won nearly 29% of the vote, according to a projection by pollster Foresight late Sunday. Leader Herbert Kickl spoke after the record showing.
And you don't need to worry, this 29% is well invested. It's an excellent investment for the Freedom Party because one thing has happened today. We have actually opened this door. We have opened the door to a new era. We are now really going to write this new chapter in Austrian history together.
A win for the Freedom Party, or FPO, comes 7 decades after its founding under a lawmaker who was a former Nazi. The party has worked to moderate its image, but Kickl remains a provocative and polarizing figure, disliked by other party leaders. They immediately united in rejecting the notion of forming a coalition with him, raising the risk of his victory being a hollow one.
Nazis aus dem Parlament!
A few dozen anti-FPO protesters assembled outside the party's election celebrations late on Sunday as police kept them at bay. The FPO wants to stop granting asylum altogether and build a, quote, fortress Austria, preventing migrants from entering. Kickl also opposes providing aid to Ukraine and wants sanctions against Russia withdrawn. The FPO has faced backlash from other parties because of its criticism of the EU and failure to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. President Alexander von der Bellen, who oversees the formation of governments, urged parties to find common ground in negotiations in the coming weeks. If Kickl cannot persuade another party to ally with him, it could end the FPO's hopes of forming a government and open the door to a coalition of more moderate parties.
That's Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting for us today.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg is wrapping up his time as chief of the military alliance. Former Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte will officially step into the role on Tuesday. Rutte is expected to carry on Stoltenberg's priorities, including working to hold the alliance together, continue supporting Ukraine amid fears over Moscow's next move, and political uncertainty in Washington.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish, along with Lori London in Washington. A close look at the hunger crisis in Sudan is coming up, but first, we take a deep dive into American politics and its international repercussions. In the American Midwest, a local fight over a Chinese electric vehicle battery factory reflects the broader U.S. controversy over Chinese investments in the United States. VOA's Calla Yu reports on how the issue of U.S.-China competition is playing out in a small city in Michigan during this year's presidential election season.
Big Rapids, a small city of nearly 8,000 in Mecosta County, Michigan. Much of his public life takes place here at Pat Curry's service station. a Chinese company called Goshen, has deeply divided this part of the state.
The devil's at work in our community right now.
The company is planning to invest $2.4 billion to build a plant in the area to manufacture electric vehicle battery components, drawing mixed reactions from residents. Al Lawson lives in Big Rapids.
For the overall economy, it's going to be a boost.
Resident Donald Helder likes having Goshen here.
Because we send so much U.S. dollars to China, we need to figure out some way as to how to get some of that back here by way of investment in our American economy.
But others worry about Goshen's links to China. Bruce Borkovich owns a farm near the plant site.
I'm 100% no Goshen. I think there's serious environmental concerns, but for me, those are probably outshadowed by the security concerns.
FBI Director Christopher Wray warned about the blurry line between the Chinese government and its private sector, and the potential that Beijing could exploit U.S. vulnerabilities and undermine its national security. Goshen did not respond to VOA's request for comment. Goshen was founded in China, and its U.S. subsidiary is headquartered in California. Its board members hail from China, the U.S., and Germany. Vice President of North American Manufacturing Chuck Thielen said his company is being singled out.
Something made someone decide Goshen's a scapegoat when we have very similar business practices to many companies already here.
Chinese investment in the U.S. has been a talking point in this year's presidential election. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance are accusing Democrats of using taxpayer money to pay China to set up shop in the U.S. Here's Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump.
China is buying up our technology. They're buying up food supplies. They're buying up our farmland.
According to the New York Times, Goshen received $800 million in subsidies from Michigan's Strategic Fund and may be eligible for Inflation Reduction Act tax credits. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and other Democrats contend that incentives to companies like Goshen help keep business in the state rather than overseas. In May, Whitmer said, "We cannot let Chinese companies be the only ones innovating around electric vehicles, because then they will eat our lunch the way we're seeing happen in Europe." Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris also addressed U.S.-China competition in her keynote speech to the Democratic National Convention.
"I will make sure that we lead the world into the future on space and artificial intelligence, that America, not China, wins the competition for the 21st century."
Some residents here say the U.S.-China competition is coloring the debate, including Al Lawson.
"Well, the resistance comes from the national issue that made everything kind of anti-Chinese."
And the Goshen issue has put Big Rapids on the campaign map, with Vance stopping here in August. Kelly Yu, VOA News, Big Rapids, Michigan.
Turning to the African continent, the Sudanese army on Monday rejected an accusation by the United Arab Emirates that Sudan's forces had bombed the residence of the UAE ambassador in Khartoum, instead blaming the paramilitary rapid support forces. The conflict that erupted in Sudan in April 2023 between the army and the rapid support forces has unleashed waves of ethnic violence, created the world's largest internal displacement crisis, and, as David Doyle with Reuters reports, pushed millions to the brink of starvation.
This is 12-year-old Khalil. He's in hospital after, exhausted from hunger, he fell as he fled his home in Sudan's South Kordofan with his mother and two other siblings. He will be dead in 2 days. Amid Sudan's civil war, more than half the 50 million population are suffering from extreme hunger. Hundreds are estimated to be dying each day. But life-saving international aid is unable to reach millions of people who desperately need it. Khalil's mother, Rhoda Tier, describes how they had been surviving.
"He was eating tree leaves. There isn't any food that is suitable for human consumption. You can only eat things that aren't good for you." The only thing we can do is cut the tree leaves and boil them in hot water so he can digest them. We couldn't eat like normal people.
Leaves have also become a staple for thousands at this sprawling displacement camp, also in South Kordofan. Rauz Fleg and other emaciated women walk for 2 hours each day to collect them from a forest. The mother of nine says that since she arrived here at the start of the year, UN aid food has made it through only once, back in May. Her family's share lasted just 10 days.
I'm scared of being here because I don't know if I will live or I will die.
Sudan is a stark example of what happens when the final stage in an elaborate global system to tackle hunger, the delivery of food, breaks down. And it exposes a shaky premise on which this system rests, that governments will welcome help. UN relief agencies won't dispense aid in places without the approval of Sudan's government, which is backed by the military. But minutes from internal meetings show that UN and NGO logistics coordinators have reported for 4 months in a row, from May to August, that Sudanese authorities are refusing to issue travel permits for aid convoys to places in South Kordofan and Darfur. Reuters reporting has shown the army's main foe, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, is also using food as a weapon. It has looted aid hubs and blocked relief agencies from accessing areas at risk of famine, including displaced persons' camps in Darfur and areas of South Kordofan. The RSF has also conducted an ethnic cleansing campaign against the Masalit people in Darfur, driving hundreds of thousands from their homes and creating the conditions for famine.
That was David Doyle with Reuters reporting for us.
Meanwhile, authorities continue their efforts to rescue migrants lost at sea on their way to the Canary Islands. Diane Toe of Reuters has the story.
Hopes of finding dozens of migrants missing after the boat sank off the Canary Islands were diminishing, authorities said on Sunday, in what could be the deadliest migrant crossing incident from Africa to the Canaries in decades. Patrol boats and helicopters continued a second day of search near the Spanish island of El Hierro after emergency services received a distress call from the boat in the early hours of Saturday. They said wind and poor visibility made the rescue extremely difficult and that the boat sank during the rescue attempt. Rescuers were able to pick up 27 of 84 migrants from the boat, but at least 9 people died in the incident, authorities said, including a child. Candelaria Delgado, who heads up the Canary Islands Regional Social Welfare Department, said minors who have arrived are at a temporary reception center. She urged the Spanish government to activate a mechanism with the European Union that would allow minors to be transferred to other parts of the continent, saying the island needed help tackling the humanitarian crisis. Bracing for the expected fate for those still missing, Delgado said it would make this incident the biggest crisis the Canaries have experienced in 30 years. Data from the EU's border agency Frontex showed that the route from Africa to the islands has seen a surge in migrants this year, with more than 21,000 crossing in the first 7 months. 3 other boats reached the Canary Islands on Saturday night, carrying more than 200 migrants.
That's Reuters' Diane Toe reporting.
And finally, today in climate news, Britain's last coal-fired power plant closed for good on Monday, ending 142 years of coal-generated electricity in the nation that sparked the Industrial Revolution. The shutdown makes Britain the first country from the group of 7 major economies to phase out coal. Emergency responders in North Carolina Monday were racing to try to reach people who remain unaccounted for 3 days after Hurricane Helene ripped through the southeastern United States, wiping out communications and leaving millions without power. At least 107 people in 6 states have been killed in the storm.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of Lori London and all of us here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.